I speak to you in the name of the living God, blessed Trinity, and lover of your souls. Amen. Your heart rate increases and blood pressure rises as your body primes your muscles for potential exertion. Your breathing becomes rapid, delivering more oxygen to the brain, preparing you to react quickly. Your hands sweat and shake as adrenaline surges through your body, muscles tense, stomach tightens, pupils dilate, hair stands on end. You are feeling afraid. In our English New Testaments, various words are translated as fear more than 300 times. That's the New Testament. Now, it's not as many times as love and faith are mentioned, but fear is mentioned more often than the words grace and hope combined. Fear is a prominent emotion throughout the Bible, even more so in the Old Testament. We read the word just a few minutes ago. We actually chanted it. In Psalm 85, salvation is near to those who fear God. Blood pumping, palms sweating, stomach tensing, is this how we are to feel about God? If your modern mind cries, no, then what on earth does the Bible mean when it tells us to fear the Lord? This phrase, fear of the Lord, can be so confusing, not because fear is so foreign to us as many ancient concepts are, but because we know fear so well. Those biochemical changes I mentioned earlier are universal human reactions. We all know what fear feels like, right? Well, maybe. It turns out that while all people experience fear similarly in our bodies, how we interpret that experience as an emotion hasn't been universal. It's changed, and it will change throughout culture and time. If we go back to the ancient world, we find that one of the early Greek words for fear is the same word as run. As far back as we can trace ancient language, fear has caused people to run away from what's bad. This was the prevailing thought for centuries, probably still sounds familiar today. The scientific investigation of fear, though, began to emerge as a field of study in the late 19th century. This is about fear as an emotion. And by the mid-20th century, the field of behaviorism began to dominate psychological thought with this idea that all human behavior is governed by an avoidance of negative stimuli and an approach toward positive stimuli. But behaviorism focuses only on observable behaviors, like running away from something we're afraid of, how fear might be shaped by environmental factors. It can't consider the development of the word fear in our languages. And languages don't exist just to describe our experiences. Languages shape our experiences too. If I asked you to give me a synonym for the word fear today, you might say what? Give me something. Scared? Terror, yes. Anxiety maybe, horror even. But in ancient languages, fear didn't just mean these things, right? It also meant reverence. Horror and reverence. Reverence may be closer to the meaning of the word fear we read in today's psalm. The Hebrew word yireh is one of the words translated as fear in English Old Testaments. It shows up 55 times in the Bible, with almost every single instance referring to the fear of God. That might be because a similar history of development occurred in the English language, which derives the word fear from the Old Norse word agi, a word that also meant fear and reverence. One word in Hebrew and in English meant both fear and reverence, so we use that word. But fear and reverence don't mean the same thing to you and to me anymore. Those are two different things. Now, in modern English, we can trace a division between these emotions of fear and reverence in our language back to the 18th century philosopher Immanuel Kant. He was grappling with a phenomenon he referred to as the sublime. If you've read Kant, you may have heard this phrase, the sublime. Kant describes an ineffable experience that's full of both fear and wonder. Sublime, he writes, it arouses enjoyment, but with horror. Now, despite this seemingly incompatible nature of the sublime, Kant's intuition was picking up on an experience that behavioral psychology couldn't look at. To feel sublime is to move towards a stimulus and away from it at the same time. Horror and enjoyment. If we only fear and run away from that which is undesirable, then Kant is attempting to explain a feeling, an emotion that's distinct from fear. Kant laid the groundwork for contemporary scientists to explore the nuances that separate fear and awe. Awe. Dr. Keltner is a professor of psychology at University of California, Berkeley, who studies the science of emotion. He's the earliest academic to write on the emotion of awe, first publishing in 2003, which wasn't very long ago, was it? Awe, he tells us, is the best English translation of that Norse word, agi, not fear. When agi emerged in the spoken word some 8 centuries ago, he writes, it was a time of plagues and famine, public torture, religious inquisition, war, and really short life expectancy. What was vast and mysterious about life was violence and death. But if I were to ask you to describe awe for me, you're much more likely to tell me about your family trip to the Grand Canyon last summer than to give me a treatise on the war in Ukraine. Now, I'm sure you're familiar with that truism, we fear what we don't understand, right? Keltner defines awe as the emotion we experience when we encounter vast mysteries that we don't understand. See how closely linked fear and awe are. But our understanding and our language of fear has changed with this evolution of the emotion of awe. So for most people today, awe differs from that which evokes horror. And no one knows for sure yet why awe evolved as a human emotion, but there are some interesting theories. One is that awe encourages human beings to allow for new and unexpected information to sink deep into our souls, our being, and help us navigate a changing world. And another is that awe helps us to feel more connected to each other, to our world, and to the divine or higher power. All of these experiences are ones that ensure our survival and our flourishing as a species. Today, awe is that feeling of being in the presence of something vast that transcends your current understanding of the world. It might be the vastness of the Grand Canyon, or the vastness of human hubris developing weapons of mass destruction. Either way, feeling awe helps human beings to recognize that we are a part of something much bigger than ourselves. Whereas fear separates us, awe unifies us. It integrates us into systems of life, into communities, into the natural environment, to music, art, religion, and helps us to make sense of all its intricate webs of ideas. Unlike fear, awe orients us to devote ourselves to things outside of our individual selves, to sacrifice and to serve, to sense that the boundaries between our individual selves and others readily dissolve, that our true nature is collective. Through his research, Keltner discovered what he calls the 8 wonders of life. This is a list of the common themes that bind 95% of human experiences of awe across the globe. As I read his list, I thought to myself, these summarize my experience of faith. I see the best of Christianity in these wondrous ideas. Now, the first wonder on his list, the most common experience of awe the world over, is caused by seeing other people's courage in action. Courage. We most commonly experience awe as human beings when we see kindness and strength and the overcoming of suffering. Around the world, all people are most likely to feel awe, 95% of people are most likely to feel awe when moved by moral beauty. Keltner shares some stories of moral beauty from his study, such as a mother who watched her daughter deal with the stillbirth of her son and experienced awe at the woman she saw her child become. Or a soldier who saw an officer risk his life in combat. He experienced awe watching this officer drag another man to safety. Exceptional virtue, character, goodness of intention and action moves us to awe. Today's psalm is one such instance. It's a song likely written by the sons of Korah after Israel's return from Babylonian exile, praying for restoration and divine favor. The writers recognize the moral beauty of God and ask the divine for salvation from their suffering. It's in this context that we read, "Salvation is near to those who fear God." To fear God here doesn't mean to be afraid of God. That's not what brings salvation. It means to stand in awe of God's moral beauty, especially as we face suffering. And that's just the first of Keltner's 8 wonders of life. I see our faith in all 8 of them. The second most common global experience of awe is what Keltner calls collective effervescence. He describes moments of shared energy and excitement that arise during ceremonies and rituals, like weddings, he says. We might cry collectively at a wedding or clap in unison at a baptism, bow our heads together in prayer at Eucharist. When human beings share similar positive feelings of connection and belonging, we experience awe. The third global experience of awe is nature. Reveling in the wonder of God's creation. The fourth is music, basking in the glorious hymns that we sing today. The fifth is visual design, the holiness of the transcendent architecture of a cathedral like this one. The sixth is spirituality, our experience of connection to something or someone greater than ourselves. The seventh is big ideas, which Keltner also calls epiphany, not only the name of one of our seasons. It's the experience of understanding essential truths about life. Big ideas are the moments that our preconceived notions are challenged and our understanding stretches because we have to grow. The eighth and final wonder of life is life and death. Being present to the moment that new life enters the world at birth, as well as present to the moment a life leaves this world for somewhere else. So if there's one emotion to sum up my experience of the Christian faith, it just might be awe. And I hope that our biblical translations catch up to this science of emotion and swap out some of those words where we read fear instead of awe, because our scriptures would make a whole lot more sense, I think, to some people today. If instead of proclaiming salvation is near to those who fear God, we proclaim salvation is near to those who are in awe of God? And that popular Psalm 111:10 would make a lot more sense too. The awe of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Swap out almost any verse you'd like that has YHWH and plop in the word awe instead. The awe of the Lord is a fountain of life, turning a person away from the snares of death. Hear, O Israel, what does the Lord your God require of you? To be in awe of the Lord God, to walk in all his ways, to love him, to serve the Lord with all your heart and with all your soul. So I truly don't mean to offend the street preachers, but I don't think the Bible's telling us to fear God. The Bible's encouraging us to stand in reverence of our Maker, the ultimate moral beauty, the true wonder of life. So, the next time you're in church, or in nature, or standing at the Cleveland Art Museum, or sitting in Severance Hall, and you notice your heart rate changing and the hairs on your arm standing on end, don't worry. That diminished sense of self you feel is not because of fear, even though they look almost identical to our bodies. You are simply recognizing that you are connected to something so much bigger than yourself. You might just be connected to moral beauty itself. You are feeling awe.